Thank you for downloading this Council on Foreign Relations podcast. CFR is an independent national membership organization and nonpartisan research center. For more information, please visit us online at cfr.org.
Good afternoon from New York, and welcome to the Council on Foreign Relations, Religion, and Foreign Policy conference call. I'm Irina Faskianis, Vice President for the National Program and Outreach here at CFR. As a reminder, today's call is on the record, and the audio will be available on our website, www.cfr.org. We're delighted to have Robert George with us today to discuss the state of U.S. international religious freedom policy 15 years after the passage of the International Religious Freedom Act. Robert George is a McCormick Professor of Jurisprudence and Director of the James Madison Program in American Ideals and Institutions at Princeton University. Dr. George was appointed chair of the U.S. Commission on International Religious Freedom in 2012. Previously, he served on the President's Council on Bioethics and was a visiting professor at Harvard Law School. Dr. George is the recipient of numerous awards and the author of Making Men Moral, Civil Liberties, and Public Morality, as well as In Defense of Natural Law. Dr. George, thank you very much for being with us today. It would be great if you could give us an overview of your report and reflect more deeply on the International Religious Freedom Act and comment on the progress the U.S. has made in pursuing religious freedom over the past 15 years.
Certainly, Irina, and thank you very much. Thanks to you and to your colleagues for organizing the call, and thanks to everyone for joining us for the call. My list of participants, I'm delighted to say, includes one current colleague on the commission, Father Thomas Reese, and two former members of the commission, Felice Geer and Rabbi David Saperstein. So welcome to the call to those colleagues and former members, and welcome to everyone. For those who aren't familiar with our commission, the United States Commission on International Religious Freedom is an independent U.S. government advisory body which monitors religious freedom really across the globe and makes policy recommendations to the President, to the Secretary of State, and to the Congress. I spent this morning on Capitol Hill testifying in the House Foreign Affairs Committee in relation to our work. Along with my eight colleagues, I serve as commissioner in a voluntary capacity and have been serving this past year as USERF's chairman. Each of us has been appointed either by the President or by a congressional leader. USERF has a professional, very, very competent, excellent nonpartisan staff which monitors religious freedom on a daily basis. They represent many, many fields of expertise and areas of the world, experts on the Middle East and on China and on Africa and so forth and so on. I'd like to thank the staff, by the way, for the superb work Elizabeth Cassidy and her colleagues in putting together the 2014 annual report, which, as Irina said, is our 15. It's important to understand that as an independent body, we are separate and distinct from the State Department and from the Office of on Religious Freedom in the State Department. We expect the State Department to release its own annual religious freedom report soon. So let me explain, to begin with, the difference between our report and theirs. While neither report will cover religious freedom issues in our own country, neither addresses domestic religious freedom issues, the State Department's report will assess all other countries, providing an extensive reciting of violations that have occurred. Our own report is more strategically focused on the most serious religious freedom violators and violations, those who are committing violations or permitting violations to occur with impunity, where the violations are very serious, ongoing, egregious violations, systematic violations. In addition, our report provides recommendations for how the U.S. government can respond to these abuses and encourage reforms. We're not simply pointing out problems. We're trying to assist in the process of reflection that will generate some solutions. So let me add that we also periodically issue reports throughout the year when there are issues that need to be highlighted in particular countries, such as reports on the global use of blasphemy laws to violate the religious freedom rights of people who are members of minority religions who are who are unbelievers in a majority religious culture. We issue press releases. We write op-eds commenting on religious freedom issues, calling attention to violations and to problems, or to opportunities that have arisen for improving religious freedom climate in countries around the world. As in our prior annual reports, this year we highlighted key countries and regions in which serious religious violations continue to occur on a regular, systematic basis, along with recommendations to our government on how to respond to these abuses. And as in prior years, alas, there is no shortage of places where abuses of religious freedom and related rights occur. Our friends at Pew have a report out recently indicating that 76% of the people of the world live in countries in which religious freedom violations are perpetrated on a regular basis by government, significant violations of religious freedom, or tolerated by government, ranging from onerous rules, often enforced by way of harassment of religious minorities, to physical detention of dissenting people, people of no faith or people of a different faith from the majority faith or the faith of those in power, worse than detention, torture, and even worse than that, murder. And that dismal fact raises two immediate questions. Why should the United States care? And what can our country do about the problem? Our belief on the commission, and evidently the belief in Congress in enacting the act that created our commission, is that we should care because freedom of religion or belief is central to our own political understanding, to our own nation's constitutional system, to our own history. And it's affirmed by our nation and by many nations, by international treaties and conventions creating endorsing obligations. These are critical to the narratives of those nations that top our foreign policy and security agendas. And they're crucial to the ultimate well-being of our own nation and of the world. We should also care, of course, perhaps even more fundamentally, for humanitarian reasons. That's because studies show that nations that trample on religious freedom tend to provide fertile soil for war and poverty, for violent religious extremism, the incubation of terrorism all around the world. Religious freedom violations are highly correlated with abuse in other areas, with destabilized societies, and as I say, with the incubation of extremism and even terrorism. Religious freedom is not only a moral imperative, a fundamental human right, something that is central to the dignity of human beings, but also a practical necessity. And that's why we believe, and Congress believes, that's why it enacted the statute creating the commission, that religious freedom really deserves a seat at the table in the formation and execution of our nation's foreign and diplomatic policy. So there are compelling reasons for the United States to care about religious freedom, but then there's the question, well, what can we do to defend and advance, promote, protect this fundamental right? One of USERF's chief responsibilities is to recommend to the State Department the nations we believe the government should designate, the U.S. government should designate, as countries of particular concern, CPCs. Countries that should be designated because they're the worst offenders, countries that are guilty of, to quote the words of the statute, systematic, ongoing, and egregious abuses of the fundamental right to religious freedom. In our report, we refer to those countries as Tier 1 nations. In this year's report, we recommend that the State Department redesignate the following 8 countries as CPCs. These are countries that have been designated in the past. We believe they continue to deserve that designation. Burma, China, Eritrea, Iran, North Korea, Saudi Arabia, Sudan, and Uzbekistan. I'll say a few words about some of these nations. Burma continues to allow sectarian violence to occur with impunity and other abuses, especially against Rohingya Muslims and ethnic minority Christians. And that's despite political reforms that have taken place in that country. The problem here is deep. It's certainly cultural as well as political. The mistreatment of the Rohingya is a world-class offense in the human rights area, and it certainly needs to have priority in our policy toward that nation. China continues to persecute Tibetan Buddhists, Uyghur Muslims, as well as Catholics, Protestants of various denominations who are there, and Falun Gong practitioners. Serious violations include arrests, fines, prison sentences, detention without due process, closure of houses of worship, forced renunciation of faith, and even torture. In Iran, despite last year's election of a purportedly moderate or more moderate president, religious freedom conditions, as far as we can tell, have actually worsened, particularly for religious minorities, especially Baha'is and Christian converts, with Sufi and Sunni Muslims and dissenting Shia Muslims also facing detention, torture, and even execution. Now, besides recommending countries for redesignation as CPCs, USERF also recommends that 8 nations be newly designated as CPCs. These are Egypt, Iraq, Nigeria, Pakistan, Syria, Tajikistan, Turkmenistan, and Vietnam. Now, let me say something about 2 of these countries, Syria and Pakistan. Our recommendation of Syria for CPC designation was, for us, a first-time recommendation for that country. Clearly, Syria belongs among the world's worst religious freedom violators due to the terrible abuses committed not only by the Assad regime, but by all sides in this dreadful, horrific civil war, including extremist groups, U.S.-designated terrorist organizations, and internationally recognized opposition groups. Religious freedom violations seem to be occurring from every group that's active, the regime itself and the groups that are contesting, fighting the regime. As for Pakistan, at least 35 people, more than in any other nation, are on death row right now, or serving life sentences for violating blasphemy laws. In addition to enforcing these egregious blasphemy and anti-Ahmadi laws, Pakistan's government fails repeatedly to punish religious extremists who commit murder or mob attacks. Ahmadis are frequently singled out for abuse. They come in for particularly harsh treatment if they ever identify themselves as Muslims. They have second-class status to begin with. If they commit that offense, they have third-class status or worse. They are regularly persecuted in that country. And the blasphemy laws are used as instruments, tools, weapons to repress Ahmadis and other minorities. Our commission believes that Pakistan represents the worst situation in the world for countries that the State Department has yet to designate as CPCs. So in other words, it's at the top of our list of currently non-designated countries that we think deserve, under the statutory norm, CPC designation. So we call again in this report on our State Department to include Pakistan with the other countries it designates when it releases its religious freedom report. In addition to supporting designation or redesignation of the nations I've mentioned, this year's annual report also highlights as a kind of early warning signal. Governments that engage in or permit serious violations that are characterized by at least one of the elements of the, quote, systematic, ongoing, and egregious, unquote, CPC standard under the statute. Now, we call these nations Tier 2 nations. And they include Afghanistan, Azerbaijan, Cuba, India, Indonesia, Kazakhstan, Laos, Malaysia, Russia, and Turkey. Since we have limited time, let me just focus on one of these countries, and that is Russia. While not yet warranting a CPC designation, Vladimir Putin's Russia has continued to curtail religious freedom as part of a broader policy that undermines and attacks human rights. Minorities such as Muslims and Jehovah's Witnesses have been particularly affected, while a new blasphemy law enacted last year further curtails freedom of expression as well as freedom of religion or belief. We're also very concerned about the use of legitimate legal instruments that exist as tools to fight terrorism as pretexts for harassing or persecuting Muslims who pose no terrorism threat but are simply being oppressed using tools of terrorism fighting as a pretext because of their religion. Now, what I've summarized for you so far are the religious freedom conditions prevailing in various countries and our recommendations for Tier 1 or Tier 2 status. But this year, in addition to spotlighting countries and offering policy responses, we're marking a special milestone. It's the 15th year of our commission and of the International Religious Freedom Act of 1998, which defines our mission and really guides our way. So this year our report looks back over that 15-year period, identifying strengths and weaknesses in our nation's religious freedom policy and suggesting where we should be looking and where we should be heading going into the future. To sum up, we concluded that religious freedom needs to be raised more consistently at the highest levels of government and that the United States must rededicate itself to this worthy cause. So let me briefly discuss this in terms of the International Religious Freedom Act. Over the past decade and a half, our government has come up short, we believe, in its efforts to implement the law, most glaringly in the failure of both Republican and Democratic administrations to make use of the CPC mechanism as the key foreign policy tool it was intended to be. If religious freedom policy abroad is to become more robust and effective, this is going to have to change. The status quo isn't acceptable. Stated simply, we need our government, whether the administration is Republican or Democrat, one, it doesn't make any difference. We need the government to make annual CPC designations. We need regular CPC designations on an annual basis. Otherwise, as my esteemed colleague, our Vice Chairman, Katrina Lantos-Sweat, points out, the CPC designations become part of the wallpaper. They are up there and nobody notices them. Nobody takes note of them. They just kind of fade into the background. We need these designations to be made on an annual basis. There's no reason for them not to be made on an annual basis. So we call on the administration and future administrations to do just that. Moreover, our government must ensure that the CPC list will expand and contract in a way that reflects actual conditions on the ground. So we got to look at the situation every year and see what has happened, where things have gotten worse, where we hope things have gotten a little better. Might be that a nation that was on the CPC list has improved to the point where it doesn't belong now on the CPC list. Unfortunately, more likely, nations that are not currently on the CPC list need to be added to the CPC list. And right now, frankly, that's not happening. In the past decade, the State Department has added no new countries to the CPC list, besides Uzbekistan in 2006. Meanwhile, the religious freedom environment has measurably worsened, with downward spirals in Pakistan, Syria, of course, backsliding in Vietnam, and serious violations in Egypt. Now, Vietnam is a very interesting case. Vietnam was a CPC nation, deserved to be designated, was designated as a CPC nation. It worked. The pressure on Vietnam resulted in significant mitigation. It didn't become a religious liberty paradise by any means. But the suffering of persecuted people was ameliorated pretty clearly as a result of the pressure being brought on Vietnam by our own country's foreign policy and by the CPC designation that was motivating it. A couple of years after that, because of those improvements, Vietnam was removed from the CPC list. The designation was removed, probably prematurely. And pretty soon, as a result of that premature lifting of the designation, there was a backsliding, and Vietnam fell back into its old practices and the persecution returned to the level it had been before the CPC designation brought some pressure on them. And that's why we find ourselves today, unfortunately, in the position of recommending yet again that Vietnam be designated as a CPC nation. A better application of these tools, these IRFA tools, the International Religious Freedom Act tools, would involve a more dynamic and strategic use of presidential actions tailored to each situation and directly related to religious freedom violations. Of the 8 currently designated CPC nations, 6 had so-called double-hatted sanctions for which the religious freedom basis is now expired, and 2 have indefinite waivers of sanctions. And that means our government is failing to hold these states specifically accountable for their religious freedom and abuses. Speaking now for myself, I strongly believe that if waivers are granted, and the statute does admit of the possibility of granting waivers, and that I understand that, that's fine. But if waivers are granted, it seems to me they should be granted only for limited periods of time, not indefinitely, and only conditionally. We need to see improvements if those waivers are to be granted. But our current situation is one in which waivers are granted indefinitely and not conditionally. And let me stress that CPC designations should not operate in a vacuum. They need to be part of a continuum of action that includes diplomatic engagement, of course, consultations about possible designation, binding agreement, negotiations, presidential actions of other sorts, and waivers of possible sanctions in the narrowest of circumstances. Besides making better use of the IRFA law, we should also consider amending it, and we're proposing this to the Congress this year. While times have changed since IRFA's 1998 enactment, the law has not. The law is exactly as it was in 98 in the substantive dimensions of it. And we think the law should change now so that the CPC tool can be broadened to allow the naming not only of governments, but of countries themselves, where there is no effective government in control, as in Somalia, for example, in the Central African Republic. The State Department also should be allowed to designate transnational organizations and local groups, those non-state actors that perpetrate severe abuses of religious freedom and offenses against the basic right to religious freedom. The tools can be used so that individuals can be targeted for sanctions, travel restrictions, and so forth, so that assets can be frozen. Other recommendations on how the U.S. should promote international religious freedom more effectively include the need for the executive branch to expand training and programming, grant making, and public diplomacy on religious freedom, as well as multilateral efforts. So we ourselves as a commission are in encouraging conversations with bodies in other nations, in Canada and some of the European nations, for example, to coordinate our efforts with their religious freedom efforts, the efforts of those bodies in parliaments and in other domains. In addition, Congress should hold more hearings on religious liberty. Those hearings are very valuable. They spotlight the offenses. They call attention to them. They bring hope and encouragement to people who are suffering and to diaspora communities that are looking for some support, at least by way of sort of highlighting, spotlighting offenses against their countrymen. We would like to see legislation introduced that reflects the importance of the religious freedom issue, support for civil society and for prisoners of conscience abroad. We're encouraging everyone in Congress, on both sides, House and Senate, to participate in our Defending Freedoms Project. That's a collaborative effort that we have with the Tom Lantos Human Rights Commission, one in which members of Congress adopt prisoners of conscience and then become particular special advocates on their behalf. The prisoner of conscience may be in China or Iran or in Saudi Arabia. It could be in any country. Often congressmen will adopt a prisoner of conscience in a country to which they have a special connection or in which they have a special interest. And again, this helps us to highlight the plight of oppressed and suffering people. In conclusion, I'll just state my firm belief that if we improve our use of the existing tools for the job of advancing religious freedom abroad and create the small number of new tools that we think we need in this rapidly changing environment, we can pave the way for some positive change, some improvements, at least in some places around the world. Some places where the prospects of improvement, at least for the near to medium term, are very bleak. But there are other places where we think real progress can be made if we simply do the right thing. We need to weave this fundamental freedom more fully into the fabric of our nation's foreign policy. That was a point of the 1998 International Religious Freedom Act. And if we do that, we can bring real progress beyond these shores to those who yearn to practice their religion or hold their beliefs in peace and in security and respecting the rights of others. Well, Irina, thank you again for this opportunity to address the group, and now I'll open the floor for any questions people may have.
Wonderful. Thank you very much, Robbie. Let's open it up.
Thank you. At this time, we will open the floor for questions. If you would like to ask a question, please press the star key followed by the one key on your touch-tone phone now. Questions will be taken in the order in which they are received. If at any time you would like to remove yourself from the questioning queue, press star 2. Again, if you would like to ask a question, press star 1 now. Our first question comes from Daniel Pinnis with AJC.
Hello, thank you very much for the wonderful summary and the generous information. My question is with regard to the rights of perhaps Jews in Iran. Sometimes we get conflicting reports, and also perhaps you could comment on the religious freedoms in Israel and the Palestinian territories. Thank you very much.
Daniel, thank you very much for that question. It's an important one. As it happens, I addressed it as part of a larger set of questions, but one of the questions I addressed in my testimony today in the House of Representatives. Here's what we've been able to discover. It does seem to be the case that in the Rouhani period, since Rouhani was elected president, replacing Ahmadinejad, has tamped down a bit. No longer hear as much outrageous anti-Jewish speaking as you heard under the previous president. What we can't find, though, is any parallel diminution of the harassment and pressure against the Jewish community in Iran. As you know, Daniel, and others on the call may know as well and would be interested in knowing if they don't, Iran was a place that had a very large, flourishing Jewish community until relatively recently. That community has been decimated. It's a great loss for Iran to have lost this flourishing community, and it lost it through persecution. The community is down. The figures I saw most recently down to nearly just 20,000 people from what was once a very large and vibrant community. But those 20,000 people face the same sort of harassment, the same sort of pressure, discrimination that we find waged against other minorities in Iran. The Baha'is, which seem to be the main target, the number one target of the Iranian regime, evangelical Christians. Many of you, I'm sure, know about the plight of Pastor Abedini, Saeed Abedini, there. Minority Muslim groups, Sunnis and Sufis, all of them, all of these religious minorities continue to suffer under this regime. There has been no improvement that we can see since Rouhani assumed the presidency, and of course the same is true for the Jewish community. On the question of the Israel and the territories, follow very closely events in the Middle East, and of course we deplore the violence and loss of life among both Israelis and Palestinians. We regard every life as inestimably precious, and the religious freedom of everyone as fundamental. We know our government is working at the highest levels to create conditions for peace. We are cognizant of and learn from and encourage others to look at the State Department's human rights and religious freedom reports in this area. So we'll continue to monitor the situation, although we have not included in our report any commentary on the religious freedom situation in Israel and in the Palestinian communities. I don't know that as things stand, we would, as a commission, have a common view about some of the contested issues over there, especially about the proper balance between security on the one hand and access to the holy sites for people of all three of the religions that have holy sites there. So we don't have a common view, so we don't have a policy, we don't have a position. Individual commissioners, I'm sure, have their own views about it. I certainly have mine. But it's a tough issue. Everyone recognizes that there are legitimate security concerns, but everybody at the same time also wants as much access as can possibly be given, consistent with the security concerns, to people of all three faiths without discrimination to the holy sites. So we're continuing to monitor the situation. We're getting as much information as we can. It could be that in a future report we will be able to address the issue, but right now we don't have anything in this report on that issue.
Thank you. Next question.
Thank you. Our next question comes from Omar Salem with Religious Diplomacy.
Yes, hello. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
Yes. Okay, great. Thank you, Dr. George, for a very elaborate and great discussion of the question of religious freedom around the world. My question today is about religious freedom in Egypt, which seemed to be not only Christians that suffer there, but also Muslims who want to adhere to their tradition tends to suffer as well. Anyhow, I'd like to get your thoughts on that, please.
Yes, thank you, Omar. We're extremely concerned about the situation in Egypt. We are recommending, of course, Egypt as for CPC designation, and you're absolutely right. It's not simply the Copts. The Copts are the largest minority. I believe there are 8 million Copts in Egypt, and they have suffered dreadfully. It doesn't seem to matter who is in power in Egypt. They are still subjected to persecution. Businesses have been attacked. Individuals have been attacked. And, of course, places of worship have been attacked. Securing those places of worship is a very high priority. But it's not simply the Copts. Muslim minority people have been persecuted. Members of other faiths have suffered from religious persecution. One of the things that has heartened us is to see some cooperation across religious lines in the preservation, the effort to preserve religious liberty and to protect people. For example, there have been occasions on the Christian holidays, Christmas in particular, in which members of Muslim communities have gone to churches not to cause trouble, but on the contrary, to help to protect, as volunteers, to help to protect those churches, to create a human shield, a human ring around the churches so that their Christian neighbors can worship in peace and security. And, of course, that's a wonderful thing. But the situation is not good. Once again, the Baha'is are among the persecuted. Shia are among the persecuted. Jehovah's Witnesses are among the persecuted. And, of course, anti-Semitism continues to exist there. We regret to be in position to be recommending, to have to recommend Egypt for CPC status. It's a nation where one would hope religious pluralism could flourish and people could live together and worship in peace. But we're seeing things moving in the wrong direction in Egypt. For the Copts, for the Baha'is, for the Jehovah's Witnesses, for Shia Muslims, for other minorities. So it's not a good situation.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All. Next question or comment?
Thank you. Our next question comes from Randa Slam with University of Hawaii.
Hello.
Hello.
Hello, we can hear you.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, oh, thank you very much. Yeah, very good talk. Thank you. I really appreciate it. My question, so I guess I'm wondering if the work that you and your organization do to advance religious freedom and to stop oppression, do you include in that looking at methods used by missionaries, both Christian and Muslim, that include things that could be oppressive? I mean, like coercion, various forms of inducement, threatening, etc. For example, if a missionary promises to give a child free education if he or she converts or if the family converts, or if medical assistance is offered for free if conversion takes place, or if uneducated villages. I mean, I've heard of situations where missionaries will come in, spend elaborate time frightening villagers with the horrible descriptions of hell, and then telling them that they and their families will surely end up there if they don't convert. Do you folks also see this as a form of religious oppression?
We focus on states. The statutory mandate that we have is one that focuses on nations. Now, we are asking Congress for a reform or revision of the statute that would enable us to make designations of terrorist organizations and local as well as national governments for abuses of religious freedom. But no, we're not authorized to make designations or to investigate religious groups for their missionary practices or their evangelical outreach or anything like that. Now, I know the phenomenon that you're talking about. Sometimes people will refer to making whites Christians. I've heard that reference, that you,
yeah,
you try to win converts by offering them material advantages, food or money or something like that. I myself, speaking now for myself, I can't speak for my fellow commissioners because we've never discussed this, but speaking for myself, I see that as a terrible thing. I mean, one should appeal to conscience, to the mind and heart, not try to bribe people to get them to change their beliefs. You certainly shouldn't use coercion or pressure of a kind of psychological as well as physical. But we want to be very careful, I think, to make sure that we don't become violators of religious expression by trying to enforce rules against the speech, which we might ourselves not approve of or regard as coercive or psychologically intimidating, against the speech of religious people who are trying to convert other religious people. One of our problems in Russia is that in the Putin administration, some of the policies seem to be pretexts for cracking down on speech, where the pretext is given is, well, we need to stop either terrorism or conspiracies or unfair or unjust or coercive evangelical practices. And we don't want to fall into that. We don't want to license that or create a situation that would encourage that. Now, that's not to say that the concerns that you've mentioned are not legitimate concerns, and I think they are legitimate concerns, but they're not concerns that we are authorized to address, and whoever does address them, I think, has to address them very cautiously so that they don't fall into the position of restricting legitimate freedom of speech and religious expression in an effort, a well-intended but misguided effort, to prevent illegitimate forms of missionary activity.
Yeah, I mean, I agree with you. Thank you. Thank you very much for
your
answer.
Thank you. Next question.
Thank you. Our next question comes from Khalid Azam with Indian American Muslim Council.
Yeah, my question relates to India. And one of the things I have noticed in the USCIRF mandate is that it doesn't account for persecution of Dalits. You know, Dalits are the what they're called as the untouchable community, and they are perhaps the most persecuted community in India. And their persecution is largely centered around religious and religious sanction, as well as social customs. And, you know, even if you keep aside Muslims, Christians, and others, the biggest persecution that's happening today on the basis of religion is against the Dalit community. For example, Dalits are not allowed to go to temples, including the most high-profile of temples. And there are social boycotts going on, and there are two rape cases that shook the took the world headlines recently and got Senator Barbara Boxer and others to write a letter to the Prime Minister of India are also cases of fit the pattern of persecution of Dalits. And they are not only is persecution actively happening against the Dalit community, but the avenues by which they can get out, for example, get out of their situation, for example, through conversion, are also being systematically curbed out. In the sense that, for example, in Gujarat, 60,000 Dalits converted to Buddhism in last September 2013. But the anti-conversion law was used to block their conversion. And there's really no closure on that report. So their conversion, for example, is now in limbo. And I wanted to understand why the commission is not taking up the issue of Dalits as a legitimate issue of religious freedom.
Well, you've made a very eloquent and important statement identifying a very, very serious human rights issue. And it is one that we care about and are concerned about. If you look at our report, we do report on some of the persecution of the Dalit in the context of religious freedom. For example, we report on a Christian and Muslim Dalit rally in December of 2013. That was when the Catholic Bishops Conference in India, together with the National Council of Dalit Christians, the National Council of Churches in India, and the Church of North India, organized a rally in New Delhi to protest treatment of Christian and Muslim Dalits as compared to Hindu Dalits. And the police there intervened, of course, in the peaceful demonstration with scores of people injured. So yes, there is a very serious issue there, and it is one that touches on issues of religious freedom. And I think you're right to highlight the anti-conversion laws, and they are something of which we've been very critical. We are pressing and we are calling on our government to press India to get rid of these anti-conversion laws, certainly not add any new ones, because they're utterly incompatible with international human rights standards and with international obligations that India itself has assumed. We're worried about the situation right now in India. We're worried about persecutions being done in the name of Hinduism among those who adopt a fundamentalist view of the faith. Obviously, there has been an important governmental change here, and if you look at some of the history of the new leader, there are grounds for serious concern. So we're watching the situation very closely. We know that it's a bad situation, especially for the Dalits, and you're going to be hearing more from us on this. Whenever the issues do come within our jurisdiction or come within our mandate and touch on religious freedom, we have an obligation to speak on them, and we will do so.
Thank you very much.
Yes. Next question, please.
Thank you. Just a reminder, if you would like to ask a question, press star 1 now. Our next question comes from Aristotle Papanikiou with Fordham University.
I wonder if you could just say a little bit more about how you interpret Putin's relationship to the Russian Orthodox Church vis-a-vis religious freedom, and how, in relation to that, how you might respond to claims by Putin that an organization like yours only really represents a particular Western biased understanding of religious freedom, and that Russia is really not against religious freedom, but offering their own particular contextual understanding of human rights and human freedoms. Thank you.
Well, thank you for that that question. Of course, that is what Putin and his apologists do say. Look, we are not imperialistically attempting to impose on other nations an American or Western understanding of religious freedom. We realize that there are differences. There are differences, for example, between our country and other countries on church state issues. Even a country as close to ours historically and in the wars of the 20th century as Britain. Britain has an established church. We don't have an established church. We have a prohibition on established churches. We're not imagining that because Britain has an established church, it's a religious freedom abuser, and that we should be pressing Britain to disestablish the Anglican Church. We realize there can be a diversity of ways of organizing religion-state relations among freedom-loving nations, consistent with nations that respect religious freedom, as our nation basically does, and as Britain basically does. However, there are international standards, and nations like Russia have signed on to these international standards that go all the way back to the Declaration on Human Rights of 1948, the Universal Declaration of 1948, and then many instruments that have been agreed to since then. We're trying to hold nations like Russia to these international standards. They're not saying you cannot have an established religion, you can't make the Orthodox Church an established religion. They are saying that whether you have an established religion or don't have an established religion, you have to respect the basic religious freedom rights of people who don't happen to belong to the established church. I myself lived for 5 years in Britain as a graduate student and then as a visiting professor at Oxford University. I'm not a member of the Anglican Church, so I was a member of a non-established church. But my freedom was respected. I could worship in line with my own conscience. I could think and talk and practice and advocate in the public square with my own conscience leading the way, even if I was in disagreement with some feature of Anglicanism. And the same could be true and should be true in Russia. The problem in Russia, of course, is the Orthodox Church is not only given the status of a kind of established church, it's given a kind of favoritism that radically disadvantages people who are members of other faiths. And of course, since Russia has a policy of having recognized religions, Orthodoxy, Islam, a few others, you have some religions that aren't even recognized at all and end up being treated as if they are oppressive cults or outlaw faiths or something like that. And obviously that's illegitimate. They are subjected to harassment when they simply express their faith or try to spread their faith or to win converts. The methods that are used by the Russian government to protect, give the special protection to the Orthodox Church, to protect them against people of other faiths trying to win converts, just violate international human rights standards. And of course, this is par for the course. I mean, the Putin regime is not only a violator of religious freedom rights, but lots of other rights, so we wouldn't expect anything different in the religious freedom area. But we certainly shouldn't be deflected from our mission of promoting human rights everywhere, including Russia, by the false claim that we're engaging here in a kind of cultural imperialism or imposing a uniquely American idea of church-state relations on the Russians. We're not doing that at all. We're really just asking them to live up to the international standards that they themselves profess to live up to, but actually don't.
Okay, thank you. Just one thing to note. Russia, the Orthodox Church is not actually the established church
Russia. Yeah, so I said it's functioning like an established. I said functioning like an established church.
Okay, yeah, thank you so much.
You're very welcome.
Next question, please.
Thank you. Our next question comes from Shag Umben with Muslim Peace Coalition.
Thank you for a very informative discussion. And I'm very pleased that Pakistan is being pursued for the persecution of its minorities. Two other countries in the region, Burma, horrendous, the longest running genocide perhaps in the world. But Sri Lanka is going that route unless something is done to prevent it. So does the commission wait for something to happen, or does it foresee things and try to stop it? And similarly, with the rise to power in India of Narendra Modi, who is a member of a supremacist organization, and the promise of that organization to have more anti-conversion laws, what are the commission's concrete plans? And the one last thing, and commission probably comes under attack by the followers of the Hindutva supremacist ideology in the U.S. more than anybody else. I mean, the Russian supporters of Putin do not attack the commission in the U.S., nor does the supporters of Iran attack it, but the supporters of Hindutva supremacy are always attacking the commission. So what does the commission do to you know, clarify its stand on the persecution of minorities in India?
Well, thank you for that question. I spoke a few moments ago, I don't know if you were on the call, about the situation in India, and we are concerned about the new government in India because of the new leader's previous association with groups that have been hostile to religious freedom. We're concerned about fundamentalism, the imposition and persecution, impositions on and persecution of religious minorities. So India is one of our tier two countries. We are taking a strong stand when it comes to India, and we just hope that the situation does not play out the way we fear it will. We'd like to be able to take India off of tier two, not move it up to tier one in a recommendation for CPC status. So we're watching it closely. Now, you raise the issue of Sri Lanka. Yes, we are watching the situation in Sri Lanka, and we're increasingly concerned about the religious freedom situation there. In the last year, there have been numerous attacks against religious minority communities, and those include Muslims, Hindus, and Christians, by extremist Buddhist monks and laity affiliated with the Sinhalese Buddhist nationalist groups such as Bodu Bala Sena and Sinhala Rabaya. In addition, USERF received multiple reports that government officials and police are just allowing violence to occur with impunity, doing nothing to stop religiously motivated attacks, and in some cases actually even have government officials participating in them and just not providing protection for minority communities, and even harass minority communities at their houses of worship, a little bit like the situation that we in fact a lot like the situation that we're concerned about because of what we've seen in Egypt. Now, we haven't made Sri Lanka a tier two country, but we do discuss it in the report. We list it among what we call watch list countries. They're on our watch list, and they're on our watch list because they deserve to be watched. We need to watch them because we see situations possibly deteriorating there. My understanding is that there was actually an attack on Muslims by Buddhists just in the last week. We don't have all the details, but the best information we have is that four people are killed in those attacks. So, yes, there's a problem there.
Thank you very much. Dr. George, this has been a great and very insightful hour. Are there any closing thoughts that you would like to leave us with?
Well, yes. The people who are on this call are people of influence and people who wouldn't be on the call except that they have the concerns that we have about religious freedom in the world. And I'll remind you of something I said at the beginning. According to Pew, which is a very reliable source, 76% of the people of the world live under regimes that are regular violators of religious liberty or who stand by with impunity as mobs and terrorists attack people based on religion or belief. So the people on this call can have an impact. You can use your influence to support the work that we're doing and that so many wonderful NGO and human rights religious liberty groups are doing, trying to remind our own government of the importance of religious freedom, both as a human right and as something that's important to our own security and to international security, reminding our own leaders in Congress and in administrations that there is a strong correlation between bad religious freedom conditions and violations of religious freedom and bad things like poverty and abuse and destabilized regimes and the incubation of extremism and terrorism. So we hope that you'll join with us. We want to be your partners in elevating religious freedom to the status that it deserves under the International Religious Freedom Act of 1998. We're not actually asking for anything fundamentally new here in our law. We have a few revisions to bring the law up to date that we're proposing, but the basic core of what we're asking for is already the law of our land, and we just need our public officials be aware of that, be cognizant of that, and not put religious freedom on the back of the bus or relegated to second or third class status. It needs to be right up there. Now, we recognize that there are other concerns in foreign policy. You know, obviously trade concerns are important, and there will always be advocates for those concerns. Geostrategic military concerns are very important. Any administration has got to give those priority. But religious freedom is important, too. It's important both because of its intrinsic significance as a human right and because of its instrumental value to us in helping to make a world that is secure for our own people and for everyone across the globe. And Irina, again, thank you so much for allowing me and our commission to speak to your distinguished group.
It was a pleasure, and we look forward to looking at the report. It is on the U.S. Commission's website, so I commend it to you all. So thank you again, Dr. George, and to your colleagues, Elizabeth Cassidy and Knox Thames, who I know who are in the room with you. Thanks to all of you for your excellent questions and comments. This conference call series is part of CFR's Religion and Foreign Policy Initiative, and we, as always, appreciate your feedback and your suggestions. We hope that you will email us at outreach@cfr.org. For any ideas that you have or feedback. We hope you have a pleasant summer. We will be on hiatus and planning our new program year. So enjoy the summer and look forward to reconvening in the fall.
Thank you, ladies and gentlemen. This concludes today's conference. You may disconnect your lines now.
Thank you for listening to this Council on Foreign Relations podcast. For additional audio, video, and transcripts of CFR meetings, as well as expert analysis of international news, please visit us online, cfr.org.